Blog Talk Radio.
They said we could
stay in the last bells at line up.
Absolutely.
Spend some time in the country. We're glad that you dropped by. Spend some time in the country. Leave your worries behind. There's lots of fun for everyone. The best in music, too. Spend some time in the country. We've been waiting here for you. Here in the country, waiting here for you.
Live from Ontario and heard around the world, welcome to In the Country with Dave Woods. This is the place for up-close and personal interviews, as well as great country music from our featured guests. So sit back and relax. Today's show starts right now.
Canadian singer-songwriter Dan Hill. When you hear his name, you probably think of his many pop hits, including the classic, Sometimes When We Touch, or maybe it's You Make Me Wanna Be, or Can't We Try, his duet with Vonda Shepherd. And the list goes on, Never Thought That I Could Love, Unborn Heart, I Fall All Over Again. There's a long list of chart toppers. Dan has had great success with songwriting for other artists like Celine Dion, the Backstreet Boys, and George Benson. And he's no stranger to the country music world, having written songs and hits for Mark Wills, Sammy Kershaw, Reba McEntire, and Alan Jackson, to name a few. Dan has recently released a new album called Intimate, as well as a memoir entitled I Am My Father's Son. It's my pleasure to welcome to In the Country, Dan Hill. Hey, Dan.
Hey, it's great to be talking to you, Dave. Thanks so much for inviting me on your show.
You're very welcome. It's great to have you on the show. And as I mentioned when we were setting up the interview, I'm a big fan. I bought the vinyl albums back in the day, and I've got so many favorite songs beyond the classics and the big hits that we know. From Longer Fuse, 14 Today, and Gene are two of my favorites.
Well, thank you. I've always really, really loved 14 Today. You know,
it's a hard song to
play on guitar, but that's why I like it so much, I think.
Such a beautiful story to it, and it goes through a woman's life. And you know, I was probably in my teens when I heard it, but something about it really moved me.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for remembering me after all those albums and all those years.
Yeah, great albums and great songs to this day. And in fact, well, to revisit a classic, quite interesting, a famous boxer, a world-class boxer, Manny Pacquiao. You noticed him on Jimmy Kimmel, and I was watching the clip earlier when he was singing Sometimes When We Touch, and now you've actually gone into the studio to do a recording with him.
Yes, we've made sort of a remake of Sometimes When We Touch that Manny is singing, and I just sort of helped coach him through the vocals, and Matt McCauley, Fred Mullen, my producers, and the original producers of Sometimes When We Touch produced the track. It was a wonderful experience. He's a really, really amazing guy. And worked really, really hard. He came out of 12 hours of training for that fight that he had the other night. Went straight to the Capitol studio, still in his sweat stuff, still in his, you know, workout uniform. And I put him through 6 hours of singing. He never once complained. And then I threw my background vocals on in my studio in Toronto.
Nice. Now, is this going to be available for people to purchase?
Yes, it's going to be out quite soon, possibly even in December. There'll be a DVD showing how we all got together and sort of became friends and showing us recording the song in the studio, and there'll be a video. And I may possibly write a little book about my experiences with Manny, too, and how the two of us, you know, got together.
Yeah, it's quite interesting, and the contrast, singing this heartfelt ballad, and here he is, a boxer, you know, a tough guy, pretty ironic.
Yeah, the funny thing about Sometimes When We Touch is because it has that line, a hesitant prize fighter,
right?
That's trapped within my youth. A lot of boxers have recorded that song. Joe Frazier, for example, used to sing it all the time. And
amazing.
So there. I think that's the thing that makes it a little different than other classic love songs is that line about the boxer. It hooked in a lot of people. And Manny told me it was his he's a very understated guy. You know, he just said it was his favorite song, and he sings it after every show. So it was an interesting experience. And I don't really see him as a boxer, though obviously he is. But my experience with him is of a whole other nature than that. And I couldn't bear to watch him fight because I wouldn't want to see it. Even though he's an amazing boxer, you know, it's like
right.
Watching your brother get hit. You just don't want to see it.
Exactly. Now the line of hesitant prize fighter, when you wrote that, what was the reference to?
Well, it was just sort of like the reference of being young and being so full of life, you know, and energy and verve.
Right.
You know, but still sort of hesitant with all that passion that you're feeling, you know, because I wrote the lyric when I was 19. So, you know, at that age as a young man, you're sort of, you know, you're just overwhelmed with passion and testosterone. But because this woman was doing such a number on me, as I explained in the song, I was very hesitant about all the passion I was feeling.
Wow. Now, and there are webisodes at your site, danhill.com, where you do a great job on explaining a lot of the stories behind the songs, including Sometimes When We Touch. And I found that really interesting. I guess, did you enjoy sharing what went on behind the scenes in writing the song?
I do. I think because when I was a kid going to concerts myself, I always really liked it when the performers talked about how their songs came to be written. And because I'm a natural storyteller, that being sort of the dynamic of the family I grew up in, because my dad was an amazing storyteller, as was his dad, as is my brother, who's a wonderful novelist. So it was a really natural thing for me to, you know, write stories about all sorts of topics. Certainly it was fun to write about how these songs came to be written.
For sure, and as listeners and fans, it's great to hear that, because a lot of times we just know the song, but it's really insightful to hear that. Now, interestingly enough, you were nominated for a Grammy for Sometimes When We Touch. You went on to win your first Grammy for producing, which is different, because singing and songwriting is what you've had the most success, but you actually won as a producer on Celine Dion's CD, Falling Into You, which you also wrote songs on. What was that like, winning a producer of the year?
Well, I wasn't sure whether she was going to win or not. I mean, certainly her album was an amazing album, and it went on to sell, I think, over 40 million copies or something. But she was up against Toni Braxton for Vocal of the Year, and she lost to Toni Braxton, and that was the first category, you know. So when she lost to Braxton, I looked at Umberto Gatica, one of the other producers, and going, uh-oh. You know, so, you know, I kind of felt relieved, you know, that though she deserved to win, you know. You just can never tell in situations like that who's going to win.
Now, looking back, I found this interesting, talking about songwriting in some of your early songs. You had a song, The Seed of Music, back in 1972. You were signed to RCA, and you actually had interest from a label mate, Jose Feliciano, who we all know, great artist. But you were really hesitant, and here comes the word hesitant again, to give the song to him, to let him record it. You wanted to hold on to it. Has that changed over the years with songs? Do you still feel that way about, if it's a really personal song that means a lot to you, to let someone else record it?
I don't so much now. When I was starting out, I was getting a reputation as a writer before I actually had, my first album came out, I guess, in 75, so I was 21. But before that, Harry Belafonte had flown me to New York City because he was interested in recording You Make Want to Be a Father. And so I was getting all this interest, and my instinct was, though this was the golden age of the singer-songwriter, I still felt that for me to compete against the likes of James Taylor and Gordon Lightfoot and Joni Mitchell, that I just could not afford to be, you know, selling off my top songs and then coming up with my second best songs when I was up against Elton John. So, you know, I had a pretty good sense that I had to just go full barrel. If I was going to try to make it as an artist, I could not be giving up my ace songs. That being said, it's a different situation now because, you know, I'm not, you know, trying to break onto the scene as an artist. So, you know, I can actually make records myself, like this new record, Intimate, and already people have expressed interest in recording some of the songs off it. So it's a different situation now as a 56-year-old artist, you know, who's made tons of records than it was when I was, say, a teenager.
Yeah, exactly. Now you're taking great pride in having these songs recorded. It must be quite something to write the songs, and we'll talk about your songwriting team along with Keith Stiegel, who back, I guess, in the mid-90s to late 90s, you hooked up, and now you're getting country hits, and we'll get into the songs here, but what's it like when you're recording it, pitching it, and then you hear that cut by, you know, Sammy Kershaw?
Well, Sammy Kershaw's a great singer, so I was nicely surprised at how, and Keith is Stiegel, who's one of my best friends, or is my best friend, is a phenomenal producer as well as an incredible songwriter. So I shouldn't have been surprised, but when Keith first played me Sammy Kershaw's version of Love of My Life, which was sort of, you know, I demoed it first sort of with Keith, I was shocked at how good it was. And same with Mark Will's She's in Love, you know, like these guys are, you know, they're really, really, really good singers, and Keith is an extraordinary producer. So there's a saying in music that a song is only as strong as its weakest link, and certainly in the world of country, I've been very lucky to be working with Keith Stiegel, who I regard as one of the greatest songwriters of all time. I kind of think of him as a modern Merle Haggard, you know.
Yeah, he's had a ton of hits and produced a ton of stuff. And the other songs that you guys had recordings of, to name just a few, Alan Jackson, a song called There You Go,
right.
Reba McEntire, Back Before the War, which is a great story song. You wrote that along with Robin Wiley and Keith.
Yes. And we wrote a song called To Be With You for Jamie O'Neill for her
right.
debut CD on Mercury. And that was one of my favorite songs that that Keith and I had written. Keith is about to do his own CD. Keith discovered and signed Zach Brown to his label and produced Zach's first album, and has just finished producing his second one. And so now Keith's label is quite a powerhouse, so he's going to make his own record. So I'm really excited that he's going to be – a lot of the songs I've recorded on Intimate, like Redemption, for example, Keith will be recording on his CD. So that'll be interesting to see his interpretation.
Definitely. It's always interesting to hear someone who is, I mean, he's going to be an artist, of course, but a songwriter do their version of songs, as you mentioned, on Intimate. We're getting a chance on it to hear, I guess, six of the songs have been hits for other artists, including the Mark Will songs. You also do the Backstreet Boys song on there, a duet with Liz Rodriguez.
Liz is, again, I don't know how I get so lucky, Dave, but I have really been blessed insofar as I have met and worked and become friends with truly astonishingly gifted people. And Liz Rodriguez actually has three songs on Eminem's new record. Also
wow.
has a song on Celine Dion's last CD, Her Greatest Hits. So she sings on two of Eminem's cuts on his new album. And so the funny, strange thing was we were just hanging out in Nashville because we've been friends for years and years. And she wrote a couple songs for me for the Intimate CD and then sang two duets with me, I Promise You, being one of them. And so I have this strange pattern of hanging out with these people who end up being superstars. Like, you know, I used to work with Celine when Can't We Try was a hit because Vonda Shepherd wouldn't sing it live with me. She was too busy. So Celine walks into my house when she's 18 and auditions to see if she can replace Vonda. She couldn't speak English at the time, and no one knew who she was outside of French-speaking Quebec. So I've always had this funny life of working with these artists before their careers, you know, blow up into superstardom.
It must be pretty exciting to see to be on the ground level.
Well, part of it is I see a lot of similarities. It's actually like not that different than working with Manny Pacquiao insofar as one of the connective threads between, say, Celine Dion, Liz Rodriguez, Keith Stiegel, you know, Donna Summer, George Benson, they're all incredibly focused. You know, and they have a phenomenal work ethic, and they're also very modest, you know, meaning I think they have a real strong inner confidence, so they don't feel a need to kind of show off or strut or preen or you know, drop names. And that's the thing that has been really fascinating with working with such brilliantly gifted and successful people is every one of them have been a joy to work with and very, very disciplined.
That's great. I guess that is one of the qualities of success is to have that kind of discipline and focus. I mean, talent, if you kind of squander it, isn't gonna do much.
I think because it's such a hyper competitive world out there, and and it takes so long. You know, whether you're a champion athlete in terms of say a Manny in boxing, or whether it's a Celine Dion as a singer, or Liz Rodriguez, or a Keith Stiegel, or myself. You have to put in so much time and so many years, you know, in order to, A, get really good at what you do, and, B, get to know all the people that you have to know and to rise through the ranks. And so you have to have a very, very kind of steely patience and you have to be willing to work all the time and work because you love what you do, as opposed to saying, I've got to write this song and it's going to be a hit tomorrow, or I'm feeling. You know, you can't really think that way. And the writers I've known that have been in it for the quick buck have never lasted. You know.
So true, so true. On the new album, Dan, Intimate, there's a song on there, Still a Lot of You Around Here. Such a pretty song. Now, is there a story behind that as far as, has that been cut by anyone else? Is it going to be? It's sort of you and the guitar, and it's just a very moving song.
Well, I don't know if anyone is about to cut it at this point. Sometimes in my life, people end up cutting these songs, and I don't even know about them, and then suddenly I get a call from a royalty organization saying, did you write such and such? And then, bam, it's, you know, and this happens to me more times than not. So,
right.
I wrote it with Tommy Lee James, who's a brilliant writer. He's written hits for Tim McGraw, and he wrote If You See Him, If You See Her for Brooks and Dunn, and a lot of other hits. And well, it was strange because he had just lost his father-in-law a few days before, and he was very, very close to him. And I had just lost my father. So the amazing thing was that, you know, we neither of us talked about that when we wrote the song. You know, it wasn't until later on that we realized that we were both writing about loss, and we tried to make it the song appear as though it could be a girlfriend, it could be that you're missing a son or a daughter who's gone to college.
Sure.
But, you know, that was the thing that was really striking to both of us. We were both, the chance of both of us suffering from a similar kind of loss and then writing that song, you know. And again, I have to say that's the thing I love about the great songwriters I write with, is that we don't sort of necessarily sit down and say, okay, we're going to write a hit today. You know, we kind of just write about what we're feeling inside. I know that sounds really kind of sentimental, but in my case, and in Keith Stegall's case, or in Liz Rodriguez's case, there's not a lot of calculation. You know, you know, we often are just sort of talking about our lives, or, you know, or if I'm flown in to work with Michael Bolton, you know, he'll talk about his life and things that have been kind of challenging to him, or same with Terry Clark when I wrote with her. And you end up kind of writing songs that end up being extensions of their life, and you kind of feel like a musical psychiatrist. And I enjoy that a lot, as opposed to saying, oh, we're going to write a hit, you know.
Yeah.
It's sort of like if you're going on a date with a woman the first time, if you're saying, okay, we're going to get married, it puts all sorts of pressure on that first date, you know.
That's a great analogy. Because if the songs are going to come straight from the heart and from real life experiences, then, you know, the listeners are going to get the song a lot more. It's going to ring true.
That's what I've discovered, you know, people are looking for some kind of connection, you know, some kind of a human connection, and a story, you know, and I think that's true whether you're going to see a movie or whether you're reading a book or even looking at a piece of art. It's, you know, we all kind of feel moments of disconnection with ourselves, with other people, and we're trying to find pieces of connection again. And the songs, I think, help us do that, if they're good songs.
That's a great way of putting it, for sure. Now, let's turn to one of the songs from Intimate. There's also a video for this. People can see at danhill.com, as well as other places. But the song is called Don't Tell Me How I Feel, a duet with Liz Rodriguez, who we talked about earlier. And I understand the interesting story behind this is Keith was trying to shake things up a bit, and he brought in a third writer to start working on this one.
Yes, Keith has an amazing eye for talent. And so talent that is yet to be discovered. And he brought in a writer by the name of Mitzi Dawn and didn't tell me. And he does this on purpose. He set me up once with Vicki McGeehee, who wrote Redneck Woman, and made the three of us write together. And I'm going, Keith, why are you putting me together with this woman who, you know, Redneck Woman is a great song, but I don't really write those kind of songs. But he just likes to kind of see the fireworks. He likes the drama. And it's kind of like method acting. He thinks if I get shaken up and maybe upset and throwing off my game a little bit, that I'll dig in and write even better. And in the case of Mitzi, he was right. You know, she, I think she was a little intimidated at first, but then she came up with that line, you don't know how it feels to feel so small. You'd rather drive downtown than walk down the hall. And this song, again, is about disconnection, how this husband and wife are unable to see beyond their own issues and their own pain. And not see the other person's point of view or the other person's struggles. And, you know, the amazing thing is that it was a perfect collaboration, you know, because Keith and I came up with that great hook, don't tell me how I feel. You never touched me, so how would you know how I feel? That's like vintage Keith and,
yeah.
Keith and me, you know, coming up with these.
Yeah,
titles.
That's great.
But then Missy, you know, set it up so well with that line about you'd rather drive downtown than walk down the hall. And I do feel it's a very female line that a guy wouldn't think to write something like that. So that's
right.
The beauty of a song like that, is you're getting the female and the male point of view as the lyrics are being spilled onto the page.
Yeah, it's a beautiful song. Voices go great together. Dan Hill and Liz Rodriguez. It's from Dan's CD Intimate. This is Don't Tell Me How I Feel on In the Country.
Supper's cold, so am I. Seems you lost your appetite. You say you're sorry, you always do. Try to make it right by saying I love you. Let you know just what it is I'm going through. How would you know how it feels to wait up for you? How would you know what it's like to sleep alone? How would you know how it feels to feel this small? You'd rather drive uptown than walk down the hall. Touch me, so how would you know how I feel?
I work my fingers to the bone to make the payments on this crazy home. Get so damn tired that I can't sleep, trying to make a better life for you and me. If you could just stand in my shoes, then you might see. How would you know?
Dan Hill and Liz Rodriguez, a beautiful song, Don't Tell Me How I Feel. It's from Dan's new CD called Intimate. Yeah, great voices together, Dan, and again, that heartfelt kind of yearning emotion going on.
Thank you. Yeah, there's something about that song that, you know, I think I'm not allowed to say who, but it's on hold for a big country duel right now. I always felt that there was something very, very special about that song.
Yeah, it definitely is very powerful. Have you had songs, a lot of writers I talk to, the best ones come pretty quickly, sometimes a half an hour or over the course of a couple of hours, and it's done. And have you had any songs that you've stuck with that for some reason you needed to finish it, but it wasn't happening all at once? Maybe too emotional to write or just couldn't find the words?
Yes. I find that songs come in all sorts of different shapes and sizes and ways. And I wrote a song called McCarthy's Day about my parents. That was on the Longer
right.
Fuse album. That took me almost a year to write. Sometimes with songs that Keith gives me, like the song Back Before the War, he gave me the opening verse, and then I had to kind of finish it. And I wrote a lot of verses, you know, to come up with what we thought was the right combination of lyrics. So, you know,
right.
I probably wrote about 25 verses for the three or four that made the song, you know. Often with songs I write with Keith, I'll go through a lot of verses, a lot of scenarios, you know, up and down and inside and out. But I don't mind it. I'll spend like 2 weeks just writing and rewriting, especially the words. Sometimes they come pretty fast. I'm really good with bridges. So I think with How I Feel, for example, I think Keith and Mitzi took a bit of a break, you know, and went into the kitchen and got something to eat, and I sort of banged out the bridge musically and, you know,
right.
came up with some of the words, and then they kind of turned them around, and, you know. And then every now and then I'll have an idea that I think is really strong, but I know needs a bit of work, and I'll give it to someone like Keith or like a Dennis McCoskey, who wrote that great song with Keith Urban, For Keith Urban, You'll Think of Me, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And he wrote I Need You for Leanne Rimes, and he wrote Maniac. And so, like, I have a song called Intimate, which I wrote with Liz and Dennis. And so I had an idea of how that song should go, but there are a few things I felt could be stronger, and I didn't know what to do. And he would literally, like a computer, go bam, 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 and like 10 minutes later, he solved the problem, that bam, there we had the song, you know. So that happens a lot, too, where one of us will come in with a song that's 75% there, and there's a few little tricks, there's a few little puzzles that still needed to be solved. And
yeah,
I can solve them really fast if someone's bringing it to me, or they can solve it really fast. You know, if you're dealing with writers of that elite level, it's almost like a crossword puzzle where they're saying, well, you
right.
should do this here. It's quite amazing to see their brains. It's like a computer, you know. And it's all
yeah,
it's fun. You know, you're in their house and you're hanging out with them, and
yeah.
it, even though you're working, it kind of doesn't feel like work. You know, it just sort of feels like you're just, you know, it's like, you know, guys don't really call other guys and say, let's just get together for a visit, you know.
Right.
So I think in some ways the great thing about songwriting is you can actually visit other guys and you don't have to feel weird. And songs is the reason, but a lot of it is
yeah.
you just like hanging out with these guys, and you just can't, I just don't feel like calling up Keith and say, hey, do you want to just spend an afternoon together? So we say, let's write a song, you know.
Let's write a song and you kill two birds with one stone, so to
yeah.
speak.
Yeah, yeah.
Pretty amazing, and the high must be still so great from your first song to today, when you and Keith are writing a song, to come across that new hook, that new idea, and then to feel it coming together.
Well, yeah, I think I really like the process of the writing, and what I always say is I love performing, and I perform an awful lot, but that the thing about a song, writing a song as opposed to performing, is once you perform that show, it's over, you know, and you're left kind of thinking, did that happen? Was it real? Was it in my imagination?
Right.
Was I good? It's all kind of over. Whereas if you write a really, really good song, you feel some kind of tangible evidence of that's always going to be there. You know, you've created this piece of work that will be there for the rest of your life. And I think that's why I've always, in a certain way, you know, as much as I love performing, and I use performing as a way sometimes to figure out how to better record the song, or I'll come up with even better lyrics as I'm performing the song.
Oh, okay.
But But I find that the writing of the song gives me the greatest artistic satisfaction. And it's also very creatively challenging, you know. So whereas performing is more physical, you know, you know, you've got to be in really good shape. You've got to sing really well. You've got to make sure you're going from piano to guitar seamlessly. Whereas writing is very, it's more mental, you know. And I think I've always sort of liked that mental challenge of coming up with these words and chords and stories.
And the type and the type of songs that you write, recorded by yourself or by others, are the kind of songs that people take into their hearts. And maybe it's something that reminds them of when they met somebody they were going to marry, or some special moment in their life. These type of songs really frame those memories.
Yeah, you know, the thing is that when you write the song, you're so lost in writing the song. You just, you know, like you're just trying so hard to make it work, to tell the story, that part of the innocence is that you're not really cognizant of how people are going to relate to it. You just see the song and you're just trying to make it work. You're just trying to tell the story in this really poignant way that is also new and fresh, you know, that people haven't heard before. And you kind of, you get so lost inside it that then you end up being surprised when people actually say, wow, that line about such and such and so that really got to me. And you've kind of forgotten it because you worked so hard in it that, you know, it's almost, you cease to realize the kind of impact the song's going to have because they've been such a struggle for you.
And I'm sure over the years you've had, with the type of songs, as I say, you've written, those kind of reactions, whether it's Sometimes When We Touch or something by Mark Wills or, of course, Sammy Kershaw, Love of My Life, those must be ones that get you comments from people saying what those songs mean to them.
Yeah, absolutely. The other side of the coin is the songs I often write about family. A song I wrote about my father called My Father's Son, or songs of that ilk seem to pull a very, very, very powerful response because the father-son story is so universal. The struggling to get your father's approval, to, you know, live up to your father's expectations, you know. And so I found that the other side of my songwriting, which is exploring family issues in your relationship with your father, your mother, your son, you know, has seemed to have struck a chord. And again, I had no idea that it would.
And let's talk about that, Dan. You've released a book, I Am My Father's Son, a memoir of love and forgiveness. Struggles, I guess, for your father's approval, maybe to say the least. And I've heard about these and read about you discussing these in other interviews. Do you want to sort of touch on that and writing the book and maybe the release it's given you?
Well, ironically, I wrote the song I Am My Father's Son first and went over and played it to my father just before he died. It was the last song I played, and it was the last time I saw him cry, which was when I played him the song. Then when my father died, I was just so heartbroken and crushed that for the first time in my life, I couldn't write songs. And at that point, I probably already had about 1,000 songs registered at SoCan. You know, so this being 2003, and that's when it really hit me that all the years of my life that I've been writing songs, my biggest reason was to get my dad's attention and approval, to phone him and say, hey, it was the Backstreet Boys. Wow, they sold 1 million copies in the first week. My dad would say, who are the Backstreet Boys?
but
he was into jazz, but it didn't really matter. You know, what mattered was that I could call him and say this, and then suddenly he wasn't there. He wasn't there anymore. I couldn't call him. I couldn't, you know, and I couldn't write. And so I needed to do something with this, all the grief I had and also this creative energy that I seemed to always have. I needed a different outlet for it. So out of nowhere, bam, it just hit me that I should write this book about my dad and myself and our parallel and intersecting lives.
And was it a tough journey to write, to express and take yourself back to that experience?
Well, it was a really interesting journey. It got bigger and stronger the more I did it. It seemed to take on a momentum of its own because the more I started digging into my dad's life, and he had donated thousands of his letters to the National and Provincial Archives because of his seminal work in human rights and black history. the more I started discovering things about him. It's almost like these family secrets, because I could read all these letters he'd written that I'd never read before. From
right.
when he was 6 to 76, and I got a whole other side of my father I'd never seen before. And then I started interviewing family members and started finding out all these stories and friends that my dad had gone to university with or been in the army with. And it just became this huge, powerful thing that just got bigger and bigger. And it was highly emotional. And it was, I wouldn't say it was hard to write. That I would just say that the more I wrote it, the easier it became. Though, yes, it was very emotional. And I found very often I would have to stop because I was breaking down, you know, whereas that doesn't happen to me as much when I'm writing songs because it was just so
right.
deep.
Now, before he passed away, were you able to have that moment with him where he basically showed his approval and appreciated, you know, your success as a songwriter and a performer-singer?
I think one of the most amazing things that happened was that when he fell into his final coma, before he died, and we knew he was going to die, that he wasn't going to come out of this coma, he had had his, I wrote about this in my book, but he had had his memorial planned to the T with my mom. And he had told my mom that during his memorial, celebrating his life, that he wanted me to sing two songs I'd written about him. And so what had happened was, in a way, he finally gave me the gift of his approval when it was too late for me to talk to him about it. You know, because he was in a coma. So it was very poignant and very touching. And, you know, part of it was a challenge. It's my dad. He was always challenging me. I could see him saying in that teasing way that, you think you're a great performer? Okay, let's see you do this gig. Let's sing at my memorial in front of all my family without breaking down. But there's another part of him that was saying, I do, you know, really respect what you do. Otherwise, he wouldn't have asked me to sing at his memorial. It was just hard for me that I didn't know about this until he was in a coma.
Yeah, that's amazing, and that is all detail, of course, and lots more in your book, I Am My Father's Son, A Memoir of Love and Forgiveness. And as you mentioned, the song which you wrote first is also named I Am My Father's Son, and we'll share that in just a moment, Dan, but do you want to just talk about, writing the song itself and what led you to write it, and then we'll play it for everyone.
Well, I was trying to let go of certain anger I'd had towards my father, because he had, for so long, in very tough ways, tried to push me away from music and had never encouraged me and would go out of his way sometimes to discourage me in very dramatic ways. And also because he was so busy in his job, he wasn't there a lot. And so I was trying to come to terms with all that, all those things. And it was a song about loving your father, understanding that your differences also were your similarities, but that it was really important at a certain point to let go of the anger that I had towards my father, the disappointments I may have had, that the forgiveness that you have to feel for family, you have to feel that or you never get by it. It's toxic, it's poisonous. And so the song was about love and forgiveness and acceptance. I wrote it on piano. And I thought it was really, really strong, but it was just so bloody emotional that I didn't play it for anyone for a while. And then I played it for Gavin Brown, who discovered Three Days Grace and Billy Talent and produced the latest Metric album. He's a brilliant songwriter, producer. And he just started crying. He said, that's one of the best songs you've ever written. And then I thought, geez, maybe I'd hung on to it for a few years and hadn't played it to anyone. And then when I finished my book, I thought I was able to do music again, because I'd spent 3.5 years writing that book, not doing any music at all. And the first thing I did is I went to Nashville and cut I Am My Father's Son for the Intimate CD.
This is Dan Hill in that powerful song, I Am My Father's Son, here on In the Country.
To be your opposite, I did it well. strange but true, how our lives are like a circle now. I'm very much like you. You were my unsolved mystery, always barely out of reach. At baseball games when parents came, you were always missing. That's okay. Had your meetings and promotions anyway. Somehow I knew. The more I tried to be so different, the more I was like you. Memories die hard. Love dies harder still. I forgive you. I have no choice. When all is said and done, I am my father's son. First time that I saw you cry was the morning that your daddy died. I stood there in amazement as you packed up your suitcase. I heard you say, son, I need you here to get me through the day. And through your tears, saw the boy inside the man. It was suddenly so clear. Memories die hard. Love dies harder still. I forgive you. I have no choice. 'Cause when all is said and done, I am my father's son. What is love without forgiveness? When all is said and done, you did the best you could. I let go of the anger when I finally understood. Memories die hard. Love dies harder still. I forgive you. I have no choice. 'Cause when all is said and done, I am my father's son. I have no choice when all is said and done. I am my father's son, the strongest man I ever knew.
Beautiful song from Dan Hill, I Am My Father's Son. You can find that on his new CD called Intimate. And again, Dan, such a moving song.
Well, thank you. I'm so kind of you to listen to it in all its intensity.
Yeah, very intense. And I found myself just getting lost in it and in the emotion. It just songs truly are therapeutic for you, the writer, and for listeners out there who, you know, may have experienced that, or even just to hear that story is quite moving.
Well, thank you. One of the things I have discovered from performing in hospitals, sometimes even psychiatric institutions, is just how healing music is. You know, how it sort of breaks down the barriers and you know, just connects us all in this deep, beautiful, and primal way, where it really doesn't matter who we are, where we come from, what we're doing. You know, that's the thing I really, really love about music, is you watch a 10-month-old listen to music on the stereo, and the 10-month-old will be bopping away to the music, and you just realize how deeply embedded the need for music is in our psyches.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, totally. Our listeners can head to danhill.com. There's lots of information there, including stories behind the songs. You can see Dan on video talking about the songs and performing them in a raw, stripped-down version. And when I went back to the site again, and I also checked my old vinyl albums because, again, I remember playing these albums over and over again, and from Frozen in the Night, three of my favorites from that, Till the Day I Die, All I See Is Your Face, and When the Hurt Comes. I listened to those over and over again, and just so emotional, just so honest, and I don't know, there's something in them that I just got lost in.
Well, that was a very therapeutic record for me, The Frozen of the Night, and the songs you mentioned in particular, where it was almost like I could feel the medicine going into my system to help inoculate myself from the pain of losing my girlfriend, you know, who'd left me, by writing about it. It was unbelievable. You know, it's like I literally had to do that in order to survive.
You can feel the emotion in the songs. I mean, and I'll encourage our listeners to, because you can go to iTunes, and the great thing is your songs, those older albums, Longer Fuse On, and the debut as well, can be downloaded from iTunes?
Yes, that's true. They can be.
Which is great.
Yeah.
And of course, if you...
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Sorry, go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, I'm constantly amazed, you know, because... I it's sometimes hard to believe that I wrote some of these songs when I was so young, and
right.
that more than half my life I've been putting out songs, and you know, you kind of there's something called the imposter syndrome. I don't know if you're aware of that, where if you've produced a lot of books or, you know, songs or something like that, there's a part of you that feels that you couldn't have really done it yourself. And so I have lots of dreams sometimes where I wake up, I mean, in the middle of the night, and I'm dreaming that someone else is, that it's turned out that someone else is in these songs, that it's just me, you know.
I guess it's true, because the songs are coming through you, and I guess when you stand back and look at them, you maybe wonder, wow, like, did I do all that? Where did that come from?
Well, I think what happens is, this is what I tell, I often do, they're called songwriting symposiums, where I lead classes on, not so much songwriting, as I just sort of give them my experience, you know, as a songwriter, and how I evolved as a songwriter. And one of the things I like to really try to stress is that we're always being creative, even when we don't realize it. And so what happens is that our brain is always taking in information and cataloging it in one way or another. And so when it's coming out as if we're channeling it in one heated rush of, say, 10 minutes, really what's happening is our unconscious has been writing that song or writing that story or writing that movie. Then we've just allowed the floodgates to open, so then it just starts pouring out. So the key to being creative is just to always be curious, you know, to always keep your eyes and ears open and just watch. Watch a baby, watch an infant. They're just looking at everything. They're just lapping everything in up, you know, and that's the kind of thing that I've found that highly creative people are still like that. When a highly creative person comes into my studio, they're picking up everything on my desk, asking me, what's this? What's that? What's that? What's, you know, just like a little boy would. And that's, I think, one of the keys to their success.
Yeah, they're seeing things like a child would for the first time, and it still is fresh and interesting, and they, as you said, curiosity, they want to learn about it, and they're not just kind of going through the motions.
Yeah, the wonderment that comes with being alive, you know.
Yes.
To keep that wonderment alive inside all of us at any age. That is what I think we all should aspire, including me. It's easier to say it than to do it. Should aspire to, you know. I guess then it makes life so much more precious and interesting, you know.
Definitely. Now on the subject of sort of looking at other people's songs and maybe offering feedback of any kind, can you think of sort of some common weaknesses in songs in general? Is it not strong enough lyrics, not strong enough melody, or is there, you know, not a good enough hook? But what sort of some of the common areas people could improve in writing?
Well, I think a lot of times people don't understand how important rewriting is. You know, my brother wrote the Book of Negroes, which was is a tremendous book, and I won the Commonwealth Award for Fiction. And, you know, I saw the book unedited, and then I saw it edited, and I could see all the rewrites he went through to make it the amazing book that it has become. And
right.
The same with songwriting, is I think a lot of times writers, when they're starting out, think the first thing they do is it's sort of sacred and you can't change it. And I don't think I've ever had a hit song where I haven't changed something somewhere. And so a lot of the times I think the weakness is in lyrics, that they don't make themselves clear. That sometimes you kind of sort of know what you're saying, you understand it, but that it's not clear to the listener. And the trick is to be very, very clear, but at the same time to say be clear in a fresh way. And also, you know, to have some kind of an interesting story to tell. So it's been my experience that very often the lyrics need more work than the music.
Interesting, and it's great that you're able to do that to instruct and encourage at the same time, because there are a lot of budding writers out there who just need that bit of encouragement and guidance, and, you know, kind of like a piece of coal, I guess, working towards a diamond with enough feedback.
Yeah, and that was really valuable to me. I mean, that's how I really learned was, as a kid, was just hanging out with other writers that were better than I was. You know, even in my early 20s, you know, I was hanging out with guys that had written songs like You've Lost That Love and Feeling, or, you know, just seminal songs that had changed the face of pop music history. And so by just sitting next to them and writing with them and seeing what they liked and what they didn't like about what I did and watching the way they wrote was a great education. So I'm just trying to do the same thing for people that what's happened to have been done for me. And at the same time, you're always learning. So even as you're teaching, you're learning. And there is a lot of talent out there. I believe there's much more than there was when I was a kid, because when I was a kid, no one was supposed to be a singer-songwriter. That was this was not a job option, right? Whereas these days, you know, I think it's much more thought of as a natural career choice. So consequently, you see a lot more people doing it.
Is there an artist from the country music world that sort of is on the top of your list as far as would be a personal thrill to have them record one of your songs? Not necessarily because they're the number one selling act, but somebody who would just like to hear your voice on one of your songs.
Well, George Jones, you know.
There you go.
Because he's such an amazing country singer and has had such a history. And it has such influence on country music. And Keith, my friend Keith Stegall, produces his records, and I know he's not going to be making too many more records just because he's getting on. So
sure.
I suppose because I have such amazing respect for his work, maybe Willie Nelson. You know, again, I wouldn't be going necessarily after the most popular selling artists, but the ones that I feel have had more of a kind of a cultural impact over the decades, you know.
Yeah, those are great choices, and George Jones, one of my favorites as well.
Yeah,
he's great. He Stopped Loving Her Today. There's some pretty raw emotion and pure emotion.
Yeah, and he's still amazing. You know, he really is.
Yeah, I saw him in concert at Cinerama.
Wow.
He was wonderful. Yeah.
Such a
history of hits. Now, George Jones to Tammy Wynette, she recorded, and I recall this, along with Mark Gray, who I loved. He had a terrific country voice back, I guess, in maybe the late 80s. They recorded, along with many others, Sometimes When We Touch.
Yes, actually, Tammy Wynette had a hit with Mark Gray, and then there was another big country singer before her. What was the coal miner's daughter? What was her name? Loretta Lynn.
Oh, Loretta Lynn.
She recorded this song. You know, and Roseanne Cash and her husband at the time, you know, that great artist.
Rodney Crowell?
Yeah, they did a duet of the song. I didn't even know that. Rodney Crowell told me this. So, again, I can't keep trying. But, yeah, he said, oh, did you hear my version with Roseanne of Sometimes I'm in Touch? I said, no, you got to do that song? He said, you never heard it? Was it hit in Germany? So, yeah, it's that song, I think in the country music, when people say who did it first, they tend to think it was... Well, if I say it was me, they just don't believe me. You know, they think it was Tammy. You know? And
that's too
fine,
funny.
You don't have to believe me. It's fine with me.
It probably is one of those songs that maybe may have more cover versions than any others. I mean, do you have a ballpark figure as far as how many artists have covered it?
Well, no, but it's been covered in literally every country and every language. You know,
wow.
There's been Chinese hits, Swedish hits, German hits, you know, Dutch hits. I mean, you know, though I have to say, I mean, even Oscar Peterson did a piano version of it, you know, Doc Severson cut it. So there's been a lot of different types of people that recorded the song. Tina Turner, I mean, Rod Stewart, Barry Manilow.
Yeah, Barry Manilow.
So it's sort of a Donny Osmond, you know. So it's all over the map, you know. It's quite peculiar. There have been dance hits of the song, you know. I remember walking around in Sweden on a writing assignment, the song comes over the air, and it's kind of like a convenience store. I'm going, I've heard that before, and then I realized that Sometimes When We Touch, it was this group, this Irish group that was produced by the Coors producer, and they had a huge hit with it in Sweden and in Europe. And I'd never even knew it was out. And so it's a little bit strange sometimes hearing the song come back to you in these various versions, you know, and it takes you a while for you to realize that you're listening to your own words.
Pretty amazing, and a song that's definitely had an impact all through the years, continues to, as evidenced by all those different versions of the song and back to the great original, Sometimes When We Touch, which you've included on the new CD, Intimate, along with, I guess, the original version you did before Barry Mann added his musical touch to it?
Yes. You can download the album, and there's a bonus cut, which is my original version of Sometimes When We Touch, which I wrote as a 19-year-old. And that's a very folky kind of Jackson Brown-ish Joni Mitchell kind of version.
Yeah.
And then of course Barry and I got together, and then he rewrote the music. And so with basically the same lyric. I mean, you'd be able to tell just by listening. We call it Sometimes 1973, because that's
right.
When I first wrote it. And then I rewrote it with Barry in 77. So from a song standpoint, it's fascinating to see how different a lyric can sound with different music. People always talk about how important lyrics are, but the music beneath the lyric makes all the difference in terms of how you're being impacted by the lyric.
So true, and that's just one of the many great things on the CD, Intimate, to hear those two different versions of Sometimes When We Touch, and there's six other songs on there that people will know from other artists, and you've re-recorded them. It's a great album, and the book, of course, I Am My Father's Son, A Memoir of Love and Forgiveness. People can head to your website and get more information on purchasing those at danhill.com. Dan, thanks so much. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you and to hear these stories. A true honor for me.
My pleasure, David. It feels like we've been talking for 5 minutes. I can't believe the time has flown by like this.
I know. It's wonderful. I've enjoyed it tremendously. My guest today has been Canadian singer, songwriter, and author Dan Hill. I'm Dave Woods, and that'll wrap up this edition of In the Country.
Spend some time in the country. We're glad that you dropped by. Spend some time in the country. Leave your worries behind. There's lots of fun for everyone. The best in music too. Spend some time in the country. We've been waiting here.